ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From neighbouring Gaza, Palestinian militants parachute themselves into southern Israel. More armed groups arrive by road.
One of the world's most advanced militaries, taken by surprise.
There's often been rockets fired from the Gaza Strip into southern Israel, but to actually have Palestinian gunmen shooting is something that we have not seen for a long, long time.
No one was expecting Hamas to do anything like this.
The Hamas attack on Israel is being called the country's 9/11, both inflicting shock and trauma on a population. They also represent a stunning failure of intelligence from two countries that are considered among the best in the world. On Rear Vision this week, how did Israeli intelligence miss the planning for this attack and underestimate the capabilities of Hamas so profoundly? And what answers can be found in examining other intelligence failures throughout history?
American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Let's stay quiet.
We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York.
I was in the White House when 9/11 took place. I was in my office getting ready for the day, and at about 9 o'clock, I went over to the White House Situation Room where we were having a staff meeting of the senior staff of the National Security Council.
Bruce Riedel spent 30 years with the CIA and was working for the organization in 2001.
Just before I left for that meeting, I was informed that one airplane had hit the towers. But our immediate assumption was that, you know, this is probably some small little Piper Cub or something like that. Not a big deal. Once the meeting began, Dr. Rice was chairing the meeting. The door opens and in comes the senior duty officer who says to her, Dr. Rice, a second airplane has hit the World Trade Center. America is under attack.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in.
In the aftermath of 9/11, and as a result of the commission that was set up to work out what went wrong in US intelligence, both the CIA and FBI were criticized for not sharing information that might have helped pick up what Al-Qaeda was planning.
To its credit, the CIA and the intelligence community had been warning all summer that a major Al-Qaeda operation was coming. Well, they didn't know, of course, the target. And they didn't know the date. In retrospect, as we discovered later, they did know that there were two Al-Qaeda operatives who'd entered the United States months in advance. But that information was not shared with anybody outside the CIA. It wasn't shared with the FBI. It wasn't shared with the White House. And it wasn't shared with local and state police services. That was a tragic breakdown. Two Al-Qaeda operatives being in the United States was dramatic news once we learned about it. And had that information been properly disseminated, I think there's a very good chance 9/11 would never have happened.
FBI agents around the country had heard rumors that there were people from the Middle East who were taking flight training in Arizona and Canada and other places. And oddly enough, they were not particularly interested in learning how to take off or land a plane. They were constantly asking questions about how to maneuver a plane in mid-flight. And this made some of the instructors suspicious, and they went to local FBI people and told them. The local FBI people then relayed that back to Washington, D.C., and guess what, Jennifer? The information was not taken seriously. It was ignored. It's hard to believe now in retrospect.
Locke Johnson is an academic and author and has spent decades examining intelligence agencies.
We now know some messages before 9/11 in Urdu that talked about there might be an attack. These were terrorists talking to one another, and we were intercepting their communications. But it was only on the 12th of September, if you can imagine, that we finally translated what we had intercepted, but it came too late. So the flood of information, getting through it, translating it, and then once you've got it translated and you finally understand you have a problem, getting it to the decision makers who have about 10 minutes a day to read intelligence reports, and that's the best of them. Most of them may not even read the reports at all.
There was also the presidential daily brief that was given to George W. Bush and his advisors in August of 2001.
There's a famous PDB that has since been declassified that said an al-Qaeda attack is coming inside the United States. So in that sense, there was lots of information.
Here's Condoleezza Rice, who was National Security Advisor to Bush in 2001, speaking to the 9/11 Commission.
The threat reporting that we received in the spring and summer of 2001 was not specific as to time, nor place, nor manner of attack. Almost all of the reports focused on al-Qaeda activities outside the United States.
She had a perception of terrorism as a problem that dealt with American embassies or American military bases abroad, not an attack inside the American homeland. Bush relied intensely on her national security advisors. They're always very influential. But in the case of George Bush, who had no previous foreign policy experience at all, she was as more influential than maybe any other national security advisor in recent times. And they just didn't think that this was a priority.
There are very few events of this magnitude that are just completely undetected at any level.
Javed Ali is a former senior U.S. government counterterrorism official.
There were issues with just the way our intelligence community bureaucracies operated. That was something that needed to be fixed. There were cultural issues within different intelligence agencies and this notion that sharing was somehow a bad thing and that intelligence collected by one agency was that agency's information alone and couldn't be shared with anybody else's. There were personal decisions made by certain individuals within different agencies that stymied that lack of information sharing. So, you know, you could have the best bureaucracy on paper in the world and the best information sharing system, but if people actually don't do what they're supposed to do, then things will also get lost in the shuffle or grind to a halt.
Failing to share information has been a problem before. Take the attack on Pearl Harbor. At the time, Navy intelligence was intercepting Japanese military communication through a highly secretive program called MAGIC.
There were some indications that the most likely target was, in fact, going to be Pearl Harbor. But Pearl Harbor was competing with a lot of other intelligence, suggesting, no, there might be other sites. So some confusion about what the reality was. And then rather than this kind of confusion and different views percolating up to the White House, it never got up there because of that reason I mentioned earlier, the really misguided view of naval intelligence, that the secret of MAGIC, this interception capability, was so precious that we couldn't afford to share that information too widely because it would seep out, the Japanese would hear about it, and they'd cut down their communications and use a different set of codes. So, I mean, talk about irony and insanity. All this money spent on intelligence, and they're so protecting it that the people who need to know about it, the decision makers, never hear about it.
Intelligence failures aren't just about missing clues or ignoring warning signs. Information can also be used to align with a certain ideology or political aim. In 2003, the United States asked the UN Security Council to give the go-ahead for military action against Iraq, convinced they had enough evidence the country was harboring weapons of mass destruction. Here's the former UN Chief Weapons Inspector, Hans Blix.
It will still take some time to verify sites and items, analyze documents, interview relevant persons, and draw conclusions. It will not take years, nor weeks, but months.
There was no empirical evidence that those weapons were there. And the UN inspectors had been in there and they didn't find any. And the Germans and the French said, look, don't go to war against Iraq until we know for sure they've got those weapons. But George W. Bush and his team was so intent on trying to overthrow Saddam that they didn't really care that much. So here's the intelligence community saying, wait a minute, there may be WMDs there, but there may not be as well. We need more inspection teams going. And all of that advice from the $80 billion a year U.S. intelligence community was pushed aside and superseded by the ideological preferences to get rid of Saddam. So you can see politics gets in the way of empirical reference, too. I think one of the things that we have learned the hard way in the United States, when you've got someone who is offering a dissenting opinion, no, Mr. President, there aren't WMDs in Iraq, and here's why, he or she has to be taken seriously.
The whole group comes to the conclusion, and then any data point is fit into that, whether it fits right or not, is fit into that conclusion. It happens remarkably often. Stalin was convinced that Germany would never attack Russia in World War II, and he ignored repeated warnings from the British that an attack was coming.
Israel has been caught off guard before, 50 years ago when the country failed to act on warnings Egypt and Syria were preparing to attack in 1973. John Blaxland is Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at ANU.
As a historian, I teach my students about the Yom Kippur War and the surprise the Israelis experienced then, having got to a point of supreme confidence after the 1967 war, which was for Israel a resounding success and gave them a moment of hubris and overconfidence about their ability to defeat their neighbours and to know what the neighbours were thinking of doing next.
I think the one overwhelming lesson here is that the Israelis underestimated their opponents. They had come to the conclusion that the Arabs were just incapable of serious military operations. This was, of course, born out of the ease of their victory in the June 1967 war, when within 6 days they defeated Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. And this led to hubris in the Israeli military that we don't really need to worry about these people. And that led to what they called the concept. And the concept was the Arabs know they'll lose, so they won't start a military war. Problem with the concept was that the Arabs might not necessarily feel they had to win a war. They just had to score enough points to force the status quo to be unsustainable. In 1973, the Israelis occupied the Sinai Peninsula, and their front line was the Suez Canal, with the Egyptians on the far side. One of the implications of occupying Sinai was that they had a very long logistics trail from Israel to the front line on the Suez Canal, which meant that it was vital for them to get as much advance warning of whatever the Egyptians might do, because they would then have to mobilize reserves and move across the Sinai Peninsula. That would take at least 24 or 48 hours to accomplish. That meant the warning time issue was absolutely crucial for the Israelis in 1973. And which is why it is such a stupendous intelligence failure that they didn't get warning until literally a few hours before the attack came.
Israel had information that war was coming, notably from King Hussein of Jordan, who met with the then Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir in secret at a Mossad guest house in Tel Aviv a few months before the attack.
I'm here to tell you that war is imminent. I can't tell you what day it's going to be, but I can tell you that war is coming. That's a very controversial move by King Hussein. I mean, after all, he was at war with Israel too. But I think the explanation is he knew war, another war, could be very destabilizing to the region and to Jordan in particular. And if he could persuade the Israelis to take some dramatic step to reopen a political process and get peace talks going, that might avert the war. Well, Golda Meir basically turned him down. And the Israelis came to the conclusion that the king was misled. There were other indicators they should have seen. A couple of days before the Egyptian and Syrian attack, the Russians began bringing home dependents of their advisors in Egypt and Syria. That should have been a gigantic, why is that happening? What is going on here?
And Israel had another advantage, an incredibly well-placed source in the enemy camp. His name was Ashraf Marwan, the son-in-law of Egypt's former President Abdel Nasser.
I mean, this is like the equivalent of the White House chief of staff going up to the Chinese and saying, I'll be a spy for you. I mean, you couldn't get deeper inside than this guy, Ashraf Marwan, who the Israelis refer to as the angel. He provided them with complete order of battle of the Egyptian military, and he provided them on several occasions in 1973 with a warning that war was coming. In this case, Sadat at the last minute twice decided, no, not now. I'm going to wait later. This, of course, had the impression of undermining Marwan's credibility a bit. When the buildup came in early October, Ashraf Marwan was in Italy because there had been a very serious terrorist attack on Israelis in Italy. And he was there trying to put the situation back together and calm things down. So at the exact moment when he really needed to be in Cairo finding out what was going on, he was in the wrong place. Was only late on the day before the attack that he learned the attack was coming on October 6th. Even then, he didn't know what time. And he called up Israeli handler and said, I'm coming to London. I'll tell you what's going on. And the head of the Mossad flew to London for a late evening meeting with the angel. This finally changed the mindset in Israel. But they didn't get the report of the meeting in London until in the very early morning hours of October 6th. And by the time it was transmitted, by the time the cabinet met, there was really no time left to call up the reserves. And as the consequences were devastating for the Israelis.
What was going on in Israel intelligence at the time, Mossad and others, that allowed this kind of failure to happen?
The structural problem in 1973 was analysis of intelligence information was done solely by the Israeli military intelligence. So what's called the DMI, the Directorate of Military Intelligence, they prepared all the finished analytical production of intelligence that went to the prime minister, the defense minister, other senior people like that. The Mossad's only responsibility was collecting intelligence. They were not responsible for putting the analysis together. As a consequence, there was no debate within the Israeli system. There's a lot of reasons for having multiple intelligence agencies. One of them is they have to compete with each other in trying to put forth the best analysis. So, yes, the CIA prepares the president's daily brief every day, but the articles in that are coordinated or reviewed also by the State Department's Intelligence Bureau, the Defense Department's Intelligence Bureau, and other relevant intelligence units, so that you have a multiplicity of intelligence sources looking at a problem. They didn't have that in Israel in 1973. Only the military was involved. The Israeli Foreign Ministry and the Mossad were not involved in the production of the analysis that went to the top. And as a consequence, if that one organization got it wrong, there was no fact checker.
One of the failures of intelligence analysis by Israel back then was making the assumption that Egypt wouldn't engage in a war that they didn't really have a chance of winning. It seems like, again, similarities, making the assumption that Hamas is not going to
sort of destroy its own population by doing something that they know is going to be retaliated back in a really aggressive way.
Hamas's capability has grown. And to be fair, Israel knew this. They just didn't think they were going to use it in this way at this time. They'd amassed thousands of rockets. They knew that. They knew that they had thousands of rockets. I guess they rationalized it to think, well, that's to stop Israel from launching any attacks. I think there was a sense that the concessions they had made to Hamas were enough to a logical, rational Palestinian in Gaza would have convinced them not to attack. Because what was to be gained, right? Not realizing, not appreciating fully that, in fact, from an Gazan point of view, Hamas point of view, it makes sense to goad Israel into overreacting to undermine Israel's moral standing on the world stage, to damage the Abraham Accords, to sabotage the ties with Saudi Arabia, to bolster Iran's prospects, and to undermine the United States and its plans for the Middle East as well.
On October 7th, Hamas stunned the world when it launched a surprise air, land, and sea attack against Israel. And like the Yom Kippur War 50 years earlier, Hamas chose a day when the country was observing a Jewish holiday.
They used drones to knock out cameras and electronic equipment and machine guns that were positioned in these border observation posts throughout the Gaza Strip, and managed to get bulldozers and other earth-moving equipment in place to very quickly allow then those commando teams to just, you know, rush through or drive through. And none of that physical activity was detected. And how Hamas managed to coordinate all of that and integrate it, that's as stunning to see as Al-Qaeda hijacking four planes inside the United States.
Israel has spent billions building infrastructure to protect their citizens, state-of-the-art technology which was tailored to the kind of incursions they had experienced in the past. But the October Hamas attack was unlike anything they've done before, and the Iron Dome, perimeter fence, and other surveillance technology were overwhelmed.
Israel, I fear, has been stuck in a bit of a time warp with robust military capabilities designed for 20 years ago, not for 2023, where apps, drones, literally, you know, the guard posts being bombed by a remotely controlled drone that drops a grenade, you know, disabling the post. When those guard posts were designed and built, they weren't built to counter drones, you know. They were designed for looking down from the fence to the ground, not looking up for a drone. That's a game changer, right? And the armored vehicles, how are they getting caught? Well, because they're not designed for being swamped by people. They're designed for fighting in the open plains, you know, in the Negev desert against an Egyptian or, some other army. This is not what they're prepared for. Most armies aren't, because armies are institutions that change their force capabilities and their structures very, very slowly.
Leaders often focus in on the technical side. And I think that's probably what happened in Israel, too, is that they're so focused on the technical intelligence collection that what they failed to do was concentrate on good old-fashioned human spying. Clearly, they didn't infiltrate Hamas the way they should have, which is quite surprising, really, because the first thing an intelligence organization should do, and usually does, is to use human spies to try and enter the enemy's camp to find out what they're doing.
Hamas was underestimated. There's no excuse for that. Hamas actually built a mock replica of one of the Israeli towns that they attacked, full scale. And then they went on for weeks and weeks attacking it, doing stimulations of it. That should have been a big wake-up call, but apparently it was not.
Lone wolf terror attacks, they're obviously really hard to spot coming, but a massive plot like this, I mean, does it just come down to the fact that it wasn't in their field of what was possible?
One of the things that strikes me is that Israel used to be very, very good at human intelligence. Like, they had very good nests of spies operating inside Hamas and in Gaza. But one by one, they've been weeded out. The secret of success in the espionage business is in keeping your successes secret. You don't want your adversary to know how good you are. But successively over the last few years, Israel has played its hand. It's revealed how good it is on certain matters in conducting certain operations, targeting Hamas leadership, Hamas operations, Hamas capabilities, all of which have fed Hamas more and more information about how Israel operates and therefore enabled Hamas to develop countermeasures. Deception operations working around the limits of the capability of the Israeli state, operating below their radar detection threshold and staying out of the headlines. And that's what's caught them by surprise. After the 1973 Yom Kippur War, there was a major review of the intelligence apparatus of the Israeli state, and it exposed a whole range of failings and of little petty squabbles and arrogant positions held by the various intelligence fiefdoms. 50 years later, I suspect when they go through the review, the intelligence review out of this war, they may well find a similar sclerosis, if you like, in the apparatus, the intelligence apparatus of the Israeli state. Often this is affected by domestic political issues. And of course, Israel in the last year or so has been going through a major political disruption with the Netanyahu government fighting with the opposition and with the courts about the judicial powers of review. I think, ironically enough, Benjamin Netanyahu is experiencing a bit like his predecessor 50 years ago, Golda Meir, who had actually been a remarkably successful prime minister up until the Yom Kippur War, and then was exposed as having led a government that was not sufficiently self-aware and modest in its appreciation of its own capabilities and sufficiently across the prospect of a war breaking out.
Surprise attacks are almost never really surprises. Warnings are missed because of institutional failings, a lack of coordination, and a failure to act from those in power. We prepare for how our opponent has behaved in the past. It's much harder to anticipate how they might behave in the future, particularly when it sits outside of what we think the enemy is capable of.
We human beings are limited in our capacities. We don't have that crystal ball, and sometimes we're not imaginative enough about what might happen in the future. And there's so many things that can go wrong. And even when the information is really brought to their attention rather dramatically, let's say at a meeting in the National Security Council, sometimes they shrug their shoulders and say, hey, listen, that's just one of many potential things could happen. Can you guarantee that's going to happen? No, we don't have any guarantees, Mr. President, but we think there's a possibility that could happen. But there's also a possibility terrorists could attack nuclear reactors. There's a long list of things that could happen. Which one is going to happen? Well, who knows for sure?
Locke Johnson is Professor Emeritus of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia. Thanks also to John Blaxland, Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at ANU. Bruce Rydell spent 30 years with the CIA and is now a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Javed Ali is a former US counterterrorism official and associate professor of practice at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. This Rear Vision was produced by me, Jen Leake, and sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt for ABC RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.